to 26, 47 degrees Kenosha, 45 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Wednesday, the 22nd of November, will mark the 60th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. One of the new books that has been written that talks about the assassination, and in particular, the assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, is a book called American Confidential. The subtitle really illuminates the focus of this book, Uncovering the Bizarre Story of Lee Harvey Oswald and His Mother. It is the contention of the author of this book, Deanna Stillman, that a lot of what made Lee Harvey Oswald the troubled and twisted man he ultimately grew up to become was because of his mother, Marguerite. And they certainly had difficult years together. A lot of years of deprivation of one kind or another, great instability, and there's very little doubt, in fact, that all of that contributed to Lee Harvey Oswald's view of the world and his place in it and his desire to achieve some kind of fame or at least significance in the world. And this was very much a hunger of his mother as well. And much interesting information about Lee Harvey Oswald in his years growing up and what Marguerite was like and her struggles and what life was like for her after her son's own assassination in 1963 are all explored in this really interesting book. Deanna Stillman has given the world already an array of interesting books, including 29 Palms, A True Story of Murder Marines in the Mojave, Desert Reckoning, Mustang, Joshua Tree, Blood Brothers, and this latest book published by Melville House, again titled American Confidential, Uncovering the Bizarre Story of Lee Harvey Oswald and His Mother. Deanna Stillman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks a lot, Greg. I'm really happy to be talking about this with you.
Tell us what prompted you to want to explore the connection between Lee Harvey Oswald and his mother, Marguerite. Was there one single aspect of this that piqued your curiosity or otherwise drew you to want to undertake this?
Well, I've been reading a lot about the assassination for a long time, and it kind of syncs up with the other work I've been doing, which has to do with my own explorations into American shadowlands. You know, my books are big, meaning sweeping stories of war and peace in the homeland and the forces that contribute to certain acts of violence. And in every one of my books, I explore relationships between fathers and sons and mothers and daughters and family dynamics. And it seemed to me that given the proliferation of mass shootings in recent years, and I'm sure, you know, many of your listeners have noted this as well, that a lot of these young fellows come from homes in which there's only one parent, generally the mother, and that's kind of, that's a factor in their upbringing, no doubt. I'm not saying that people who grow up with single mothers are bound to have, you know, troubled lives. And in fact, there are a lot of examples of people who do perfectly well having been raised by single mothers. Barack Obama comes to mind. I did okay. So, you know, I can think of a lot of other people who have as well. But this is a thread running through the lives of a lot of today's mass shooters. And it struck me that Oswald was kind of a precursor to these guys. I mean, he grew up in similar circumstances. There's that famous picture of him posing with his rifle. And in recent years, I started thinking of that as the first selfie of a young man with a weapon, even though it was a Polaroid taken by his wife. But what we're seeing today is, you know, in a lot of these incidents is the shooter posting selfies of themselves in the act or even live streaming it. And it all seems to go back to date back to that one picture in certain ways. And some of today's shooters actually cite Oswald in their writings and have that picture on their wall. So that's been something that was on my mind. And I wanted to take a look at Oswald's family dynamics as that all relates to, you know, the JFK assassination, because it's been touched on in other books, but not in the way that I tend to write about things. So, you know, that was a draw for me. And in the end, I realized that not only was Oswald a precursor to the shooters of today, but he may well have been America's first Travis Bickle, you know, from Taxi Driver.
Right.
The self-obsessed guy played by Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver, who is famous for uttering the line, "You talking to me?" And that was really all about seeking recognition and the desperate need to matter. And that's something that, you know, it totally informs Oswald's life and his mother's as well.
Right. And certainly a lot of people who have come after him, we can, in a sense, create very similar portraits. I do want to make mention of this. I don't want us to run out of time. Before I make mention of the fact that in your book we see the names of certain notable or notorious shooters of one kind or another. One of those names, Carl Rittenhouse. It is interesting to see his name in towards the end of your book. The shooting incident which you cite happened just a few blocks from this radio station from where I'm sitting right now.
Oh, wow.
And could you just say a quick word about the connections that you draw between somebody like Carl Rittenhouse and Lee Harvey Oswald?
Okay, sure. I think it was Kyle Rittenhouse. I'm not positive, but...
Kyle Rittenhouse, yes.
Kyle, yeah. But I should point out, first of all, that he was acquitted, although he was tried for homicide, right? Tried for...
Yes.
Killing two, was it two people or three? Anyway, tried for homicide. He was acquitted, so I just want to make that clear. But, I mean, the connection I make is that he said he liked to pose with his automatic rifle. I mean, he said that he thought it was cool having his picture taken with his rifle. And, again, I believe this is something that can be traced back not just to Oswald and the famous photo of him with his rifle on the cover of Life magazine, which circulated everywhere, but I mean, it's an American tradition, you know. We've all grown up with Westerns and outlaws and shoot 'em ups and so on, and I'm a big fan of Westerns, and I dig Billy the Kid and Clint Eastwood movies and all of that, but, you know, I think when people who are steeped in that mythology have certain temperaments which sync up with it in a weird way, and then if you throw guns into the mix, you know, that situation tends to erupt, and especially nowadays with so many people.
Of course.
Seeking fame.
Right. At one point you say about Lee Harvey Oswald, the only cause he really had was himself. That is, that although he attached himself to certain other causes, in a sense, outside of himself, what it was always all about was finding a place of significance in the world. And your book, of course, is an exploration of how his mother, Marguerite, had the same sort of aching longing. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Deanne Stillman, author of a new book called American Confidential, Uncovering the Bizarre Story of Lee Harvey Oswald and His Mother. One of the things that we see again and again in your book is certain details, certain information about Lee Harvey Oswald and his mother and his brothers that you say have been largely neglected over the years for all that has been written about the Oswald family. I mean, right down to interesting things like Lee Harvey Oswald singing Silent Night as a solo at church on Christmas Eve when he was 7 years old, and other facets lots of different things. And I think, you know, part of what your book is about is trying to really give us a complete portrait of what this household was like and this family in which Lee Harvey Oswald grew up. And one of the things, of course, we follow is the turbulence of Marguerite's life through several different marriages. And we're told that by the age of 17, Lee Harvey Oswald had moved 20 times in his 17 years of life. I mean, that kind of instability, I should think, has to have a really powerful effect.
Yeah, I mean, he was essentially a rootless young man, and his mother was too, even though they were both born in New Orleans, and his brothers were as well. And her family, you know, went back two or three generations in New Orleans, and the Lee in Lee Harvey Oswald, the name comes from Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and that was a tradition in the South, naming boys after Robert E. Lee. And Lee and Oswald's own father was Robert E. Lee Oswald Sr., and his older brother was Robert E. Lee Oswald Jr. So there was this tradition in the South of that kind of naming, and it was something that Oswald was proud of. And I mention this because it's one of the things that rooted him to the South. I mean, even though the family was so rootless, he was connected to his birthplace by way of his name, and that was no small thing at the time. And he spoke about it to Marines he was stationed with while he was in the Corps, and, you know, it was kind of a point of pride for him. But that being said, you know, your name is not enough to hold you in place, really, and, you know, minus a lot of other things. The moving, you know, I mean, for instance, I think he was in third grade or, you know, one of the grades in elementary school, like, several times, because he had to keep starting over because he and Margaret and his brothers kept moving. So he could never really form any long-lasting friendships. And his mother was kind of a classically a rootless American figure. I mean, she was a child of the Depression, and dropped out of high school at 17 and spent her whole life moving from menial job to menial job and always struggling to make ends meet, but also always constantly feeling victimized by everybody and often expressed the idea that people didn't respect her. And, you know, she wasn't being taken seriously, and in fact, she wasn't. I mean, she kind of cultivated that beleaguered persona and used it to manipulate people. Mm. And as I said, this was during the Depression, and while she was coming of age, there was a figure named Huey Long who became the governor of Louisiana, who was a real a demagogue at that time. But his slogan was every man a king and every woman a queen, and it was something that really swept the nation. I mean, he was a hugely popular figure at that time, kind of an early and smarter version of Trump, and he just really appealed to the disaffected working class. And so Marguerite was steeped in that, and you know, passed on this idea that workers were exploited to her son Lee, who ended up, of course, defecting to Russia, which he thought was a workers' paradise, according to all the things he had been reading about Russia.
Little did he realize what he would find there. One of the things about Marguerite, you say in terms of describing her personality, is you say at one point, Marguerite Oswald lived in the uncomfortable terrain of an inability to accept satisfaction of any sort, which is an interesting way to put it. I mean, clearly she had a difficult life. I mean, things were not easy for her, and particularly at those points in time when she was a single mother and trying to scrape by with not very much money and so on. So those troubles should not be minimized. But it sounds like on top of that was the fact that she had some kind of personality in which nothing was ever enough. And, I mean, even when good things would occasionally come her way, sort of an inability to maybe fully appreciate them and to accept those. I mean, she, in a sense, preferred to be beleaguered and dissatisfied. Is that a fair way to summarize what you're saying there?
Yeah, I think that's a great description of her. She was just completely unable to take in any sort of approbation, even though it may have come her way rarely, but it's a persona that she lived inside of. You know, the world owes me a living. Nobody understands me. Everyone takes advantage of me. I mean, the flip side of all of this is that she was constantly manipulating her sons into financially supporting her. But again, as you say, I'm not suggesting that she didn't have a hard time, but for instance, she told her older son, Lee's half-brother, John Pick, that when she and John Pick's father had divorced, from then on, for the next 18 years, John Pick's father had refused to send child support. But when John Pick was getting married himself years later and filed some tax forms, he found out that his father had indeed been paying child support all those years, and Marguerite had been lying about it. Hmm. So she was constantly cooking up these schemes to keep her afloat. You know, she would flip real estate and was always juggling jobs and situations, and there was a lot of drama there. And she just passed on this kind of state of being disrespected and constantly cast aside. Hmm. A lot of which was of her, a situation of her own making, but she passed that feeling, the whole every man a king and every woman a queen thing on to Lee. You know, it's just a nice idea, but not if you don't earn it.
Right.
Not if you do nothing to get there.
And if your life is in such stark contrast to that ideal, I mean, it's little wonder how angry and disaffected one is going to be. You describe the ups and downs of her several marriages, and in some ways, one of the most serious reversals that Marguerite Oswald experiences is with the dissolution of her third marriage, if I'm counting correctly, and the divorce proceedings that ended up being actually a jury trial. And this is a man who was being unfaithful, who was carrying on an affair. She caught him red-handed, and nevertheless, he sued her for divorce, and this goes to jury trial. And it does not go well for Marguerite Oswald. And one can well understand why, in the wake of this, she would feel like the whole world is out to get the Oswald family. Can you just describe briefly what this chapter in Marguerite Oswald's difficult life really meant to her, and maybe the ongoing ramifications of it?
Yeah, that was such a strange episode in her life. I mean, it was very rare to have a jury trial around a divorce at that time, and I don't even know if it would happen now, but I could never find out exactly why it went to a jury trial, but that it did. And she felt it turned into a scenario in which, once again, this idea that she felt the cards are stacked and the dealer works for the house, you know, that view was confirmed by what happened. I mean, she, I think she was awarded a paltry amount or something from her ex-husband, but this affair that he was having had come to light, and it was really, as I describe it in my book, I mean, it was a scene right out of a noir movie. It was like something you'd find in, you know, a Barbara Stanwyck film or, you know, in a James M. Cain novel, where she got wind of it and rounded up some friends and they went over to the apartment where he was shacking up with his girlfriend, and then the girlfriend answers the door in a negligee, and Marguerite barges in and it's like confronts her husband and says, "What are you doing?" And he says she grabbed his tie. He was sitting on the couch half undressed, and according to him, she grabs his tie and, you know, kind of accosts him, and she told it differently, but it's a real, it's just a scene out of like a Fred McMurray movie from the 1950s. I think that that particular divorce had a bigger impact on Lee than it did on Marguerite. While Marguerite was married to that man, Ed Ekdahl, and I think that marriage lasted for a year, maybe 2 years, Lee had a stepfather in the house and really got along with the stepfather. And Ed Ekdahl used to take him and his older brothers on adventures. You know, they would go to the movies and he would take them out for ice cream. And he was kind of a pivotal figure in their lives, but especially for Lee, because he was so much younger than his older brothers. And Lee was apparently flourishing during his mother's marriage to Ed Ekdahl. And his brothers noted it, you know, after Lee was killed, and they talked about how it was obvious that not having grown up with a father, Robert E. Lee Oswald Sr. had died shortly before Lee was born. So not having grown up with a father, and except for, you know, this one stepfather figure in his life, really contributed to Lee's downfall. And I think that divorce, you know, as troubling as it might have been for Marguerite, you know, and confirming her view that everybody hates me and, you know, the dice are loaded. Beyond that, I don't think she was terribly heartbroken. It was really Lee who was the most troubled by it.
That was a loss that probably left a whole lot of scars. And you tell us about how, in the wake of this, they ended up having to move again and into a much smaller house in a much poorer neighborhood. Someone called it a place from which escape options seemed to diminish as time went by. And of course, we can continue to read about you know, what life was like for Marguerite and Lee, and this ongoing quest to find significance, railing against the world and society and so on. It's a strong theme that of course ultimately culminates for Lee Harvey Oswald in this tragic, terrible act he committed in November of 1963. One of the things I'm curious about is, There's a remarkable amount of detail about young Lee Harvey Oswald and Marguerite and so on, much more than I would have ever imagined would exist. To what sorts of sources did you turn in order to paint such a richly detailed portrait of both mother and son?
Oh, thanks for pointing that out. Something I noticed in reading a lot of the other books and articles and so on about the Oswalds was that the details of their lives were largely missing. I mean, there's a fair amount, but there were just some elements missing, and I figured that there must there had to have been more context, and, you know, that their world must have been much more multifaceted and interesting than what's been generally portrayed. What I look to, I list all my sources in the back of my book for people who want to find out exactly what all of them were. But what I did was go through a lot of the volumes of the Warren Commission report, you know, and that was the report issued by the commission that first investigated the JFK assassination on a federal level, and then there was the House investigation of it, and I read some of that testimony as well. And I didn't read all 24 volumes, or maybe there were more of the Warren report, but there's a lot of stuff buried in that report, testimony coming from Marguerite herself and her friends and various people who knew Lee about their lives. And that sort of thing has been overlooked in all of the other writing about the Oswalds. I mean, for instance, that's where I found out that when Lee was 11 years old, he called his mother at work to tell her that Queen Elizabeth had just had a baby, and that was in violation of a rule that Marguerite had never to interrupt her at work unless there was an emergency. But clearly that was something that Lee felt was so important. He knew that that would appeal to his mother and, you know, win her affection for a moment. She was a very withholding figure. And I thought it was significant that he made that call. And that was something that Marguerite said in her testimony to the Warren Commission, but it's not front and center by any means. And I haven't seen that reported elsewhere.
Right. There are a lot of wonderful details like that in this book, and I so appreciate that. Something else I appreciate is that you often give us interesting background information on the various places that they lived, including and especially New Orleans. And you say at one point, Lee Harvey Oswald was in a most fundamental way a child of the Crescent City. This connection is readily apparent and yet rarely discussed, and that's something that you explore in some detail in your book. I wonder if we could finish, though, by having you just talk for a moment about what happened with Marguerite Oswald in the wake of the events of 60 years ago, the assassination of JFK, and of course then Lee Harvey Oswald being killed a couple of days later by Jack Ruby. In the wake of that, describe how Marguerite went on, and in a sense what her life's purpose was from that point on.
Well, she desperately wanted to be recognized and appreciated. I mean, and who doesn't? But her, you know, in her case, the need was just out of control, so that now that her son Lee had become notorious and you'd have to say, you know, immortal. I mean, everybody knows his name. She too became famous as the mother of the assassin, and she started hanging out at Dealey Plaza and selling Lee's letters and, you know, other items associated with him. And she ultimately published a little book called Aftermath of an Execution, which I describe in my book. I mean, it's about her, about how she helped organize Lee's funeral and you know, what a great act she had performed. I mean, she doesn't call it a performance, but just she presents herself as a mother in history, her terms, and she used very grandiose terms to describe herself, and she reveled in the spotlight. I mean, she constantly was calling reporters and asking for payment for interviews. I mean, this was a kind of like a pre-tabloid thing that she did. I mean, again, in a trailblazing way. I mean, Lee might have been a precursor to Travis Bickle, but she herself kind of paved the way for, you know, the National Enquirer, or she was, you know, doing that before a lot of other people were doing, which is to say, selling access to her family history. And, she, you know, this became like kind of another hustle that she engaged in order to make a living. I think she reveled in the spotlight, but it brought out a lot of her craziness. I mean, something she said used to say to reporters was, okay, so what if my son did kill JFK? He put the president out of his misery, and she was referring to the fact that JFK had Addison's disease, and therefore Lee is a national hero, and he should be buried in Arlington Cemetery. I mean, so this is like completely, you know, off the charts. Lee Harvey Oswald is a national hero. I mean, I did not find one statement from her anywhere, and I read many, many books and, you know, reports and essays on the subject. I did not find one statement of remorse from her saying, like, wow, it's awful. The president has been killed. Nothing. It was all about, you know, my son was framed, he's a patsy, and so on. And so what if he did it? He's a national hero. And as I say in my book, really what happened is that together she and Lee formed a conspiracy of one, and they were locked in, you know, this accidental pursuit of fame and recognition, and they got it.
In the worst possible way, of course. It's a fascinating book, really, start to finish. And again, it's titled American Confidential, Uncovering the Bizarre Story of Lee Harvey Oswald and His Mother. And the author, Deanne Stillman. Deanne Stillman, thank you so much for your painstaking research and careful work in putting together this really, really interesting book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. I enjoyed speaking with you. Best wishes.
Thanks a lot, Greg, and same to you. Really appreciate your close read of my book.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And to finish out today's program, we're going to be talking about what promises to be a really exciting and interesting concert taking place at the University of Wisconsin Parkside tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in Francis Bedford Concert Hall in the Rita. And this is a concert that is going to feature two different student ensembles, vocal ensembles at Parkside. One has been around for quite a long time and is very, very well known. The other is the new kid on the block, a brand new ensemble. And these groups are sharing a program that I think is called Sounds of Parkside. And so the group that has been around quite some time is Parkside Range. And they are directed by Amy Bowderzee, who has been on the music faculty at Parkside for quite a long time. And the brand new group is called Parkside Mix. And this is directed by someone who is a 2009 Parkside graduate, Ayesu Larte. And we're going to be finding out about both of these groups and kind of what they are all about. And then more specifically, what is going to be offered up tomorrow night at this concert at Parkside. Amy Bowderzee and Ayesu Larte, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Yeah. Amy, we're welcoming you back, of course. Ayesu, I think for the first time we're talking to you on
yeah,
the morning show.
Yeah, first time.
Amy, since you have the longer historical view in terms of Parkside and its offerings, tell us a little bit about this thing called CCM, or Contemporary Commercial Music, and how long that has been part of the mix in terms of what Parkside offers to the community and to its music students.
Sure. So it started in 2016 and actually was a spark in my mind quite a few years before that, which stemmed from going to the Somatic Voice Work commercial vocal music pedagogy program that Jeannie Lovetri teaches at Shenandoah University. And yeah, it was just kismet that it was able to start in 2016. And the ensemble for that program was Parkside Range, because at that time we only had a voice track for the CCM program. And CCM allows our students to not only study the foundations of good singing, including classical music, but to veer off from that to do other styles that interest our young people today, and also give them good technical skills so that they can do it with, you know, safety in mind as a singer.
Right. So a healthy approach to this kind of singing that can be detrimental if it's done wrong. So
sure,
that's good to know. So so that's, you said 2014 or so?
2016 was when we officially launched the program.
Very good. So tell us the kind of things over the years that Parkside Range has done. I mean, typically, what kind of repertoire has this group explored?
Sure. So basically, what's neat about the group is that depending on who's in the group and what their musical interests are, that's sort of where we lean, because most of the arrangements are student arranged. So they'll take a song that they like and they'll arrange it for the group. And so basically it could be anything from, you know, 70s rock to country to, you know, more, excuse me, more kind of dance music, EDI type music. Pop music, so really any kind of style and genre, depending on the interest of the group.
Wow! So there has been, so its identity, its musical identity, in a sense, shifts by the year, maybe even by the semester, in terms of who's in it.
Absolutely, right.
Typically, how large a group is it?
Well, that's the other thing. It depends. So Parkside Range, the name is fitting because we do a range of music and we also have a range of people. So I've had a group as small as, you know, 4, and then this semester 17. So
wow,
it really, really depends.
I think the last time I heard Parkside Range, it was a group of, I would say, maybe 8 or 9, which I just loved because, you know, that's enough that you can really do some kind of complex things and yet you still have the kind of the lean texture of a relatively small group. I don't know that I've heard any performances where you were as big as 17, and I should think that that changes things quite a lot. And it is, I think, always a cappella. When I saw you, when I've seen you, you've been a cappella. Is that typically what happens?
Correct, right. Yes, we stick to that. So no instrumental accompaniment usually. But we'll hear from Professor Lartine a little bit about how maybe we're going to mix it up. but yeah, so Parkside Range, we have been able to do a lot of campus engagements, as well as community outreach performances. We do how-to a cappella clinics at various music festivals, and we do competitions as well. So last year we were really excited to get 3rd place in a competition called Acapocalypse, and our student Walter Smart won Best Soloist.
Wow. Excellent. That's great. Yeah, it's been neat to see the success that this group has enjoyed over the years. Now, typically when somebody sings in Parkside Range, is that all they're singing in? Or do at least some or most or all of your singers typically also sing in, for instance, one of the more conventional choral ensembles at Parkside?
Yes. So it depends if they're a music major or not. So if they're not a music major, they tend to just pretty much be in Parkside Range, but sometimes they also are in Voices of Parkside or chorale. And for music majors, they have to be in chorale for a certain number of semesters. And even though they might want to do Voices of Parkside, for example, in addition to Parkside Range and chorale, they manage it. It's it's a lot for them to be in 3 ensembles, but we have several students currently that are in all 3 of those. And it's neat because they get the more traditional choral experience in chorale coupled with the more intimate diving into more, I would say, complex repertoire with Voices of Parkside. and then they get their contemporary fix with Parkside Range.
Fantastic. So tell us, before we bring in Ayesu into the conversation, when and under what circumstances this brand new group called Parkside Mix was created.
Sure. So the intention of the CCM track was to eventually open it up to instrumentalists. And it just was the timing that this year, with the addition of our newest faculty member, who you'll talk to in a second, Parkside Mix was born. So now we have the vocalists getting their ensemble and now the instrumentalists as well. So it's really exciting to see this come full circle.
Fantastic. So Ayesu Laite, you are back at Parkside. You were a graduate from there in 2009. Are you from Kenosha Racine originally?
No, not really. I mean, I came to Kenosha to go to college.
Ah.
But I'm just from over the border. So, I was born in Erie, Pennsylvania, but then, you know, as a child, we moved, you know, to Illinois, and I went to the Gurney schools and Waukegan and Gurney schools, and went to CLC, and then I went to Parkside.
And what in particular drew you to Parkside? What was so attractive to you?
Well, honestly, just the program. I had a girlfriend at the time, and she was like, "Well, you know, you should come to my school. It has everything." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Okay." And so it had a fantastic music program and had a fantastic theater program. She was in the theater program at the time, mm-hmm. and I ended up doing both. To be honest with you, I ended up doing a lot of both, and also dabbling into the art program. There's a lot of great stuff at Parkside.
There sure is, absolutely. And you can live very happily just in the Rita with all that's going on.
Tell
there.
Me about it.
So tell us more about this brand new group called Parkside Mix, of which you are the director.
So Parkside Mix is an instrumental ensemble. It also welcomes vocalists and songwriters. And so we have all three at this moment, right? We have about eight people. We have guitar, bass, drums, violin, trumpet, piano, saxophone. You name it, we bring it. And also a lot of the members, they can play more than one instrument. I believe everyone also sings. And I think most everyone writes music as well. Mm. And this concert that we're doing, I'm very proud to say, is all original music. So all the music that you will be hearing from Parkside Mix will be written by the students in Mix.
Wow. So is that under your tutelage? I mean, are you, in a sense, serving as their composition teacher? Or is it not quite that formal?
In some ways, you know, I'm... So next year we will be bringing out the CCM composition, you know, a composition track, you know, a track that people can go to Parkside and do songwriting. So that's very exciting. So
yeah.
So in anticipation for that, you know, I have been, you know, I've been helping out the songwriters, you know, with their work and fleshing out their work, but you know, like that work has already been started before I came, and so that. And so these students, they are writing well. And so we want to really, you know, make that track definite, you know, like a straight track for them. And so that's going to happen. But basically, the short answer is yes. I give long answers a lot.
That's fine. So were these songs that we're going to hear tomorrow night, were they already written even before the start of the semester? Or have they been created right now specifically for this concert?
So all the songs except one were written, I believe, this semester by the students. There will be one song that the students will write on the spot in the moment.
Mm.
I will not tell you which one that is. And so basically what we've also done is I've taught them what I call like my 5-minute jam technique. Well, actually, me and my friend Pete made it up for ourselves back in the day, where it's like, okay, can we jam and not just sound like we're jamming, but like jam with form, play a song, you know, and sing with lyrics and do all these other things and make it sound like something rehearsed in the moment.
Hmm.
And I taught him how to do that. And one of those songs will be that. So the answer to your question is yes, yes, and yes. Okay. There are songs that are in the past, and there's songs that will happen right there in the moment, on the spot, for the first time, and you have to be there to see it.
Wow. Can't get much more new than that. Very good. So explain kind of the relationship between these two groups tomorrow night. I mean, is this part one is so-and-so and part two is so-and-so, or is there some collaboration between Parkside Mix and Parkside Range?
Sure. Well, I'll start. So Parkside Range, we will kick off the concert and then let Parkside Mix have a stage. And then at the end, it's really exciting because they are going to collaborate on two pieces.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be fabulous. It's going to be fabulous. Like, just being in rehearsal and just hearing them play, and it's just beautiful. And it's going to be an experience unlike anything else that's been in Bedford Hall. You know, and I think that's what's really, really nice is that, you know, it's really, Parkside's got a really diverse program, mm-hmm. right? It's like, you know, Amy was saying before, with the vocalists, you know, like if you want more support, you want a bigger groove, you could be in chorale. If you want to be more independent, you can be in voices. If you want brand new stuff where you're the only one on your part and sometimes you're writing your own stuff, you're in range. It's fantastic.
Hmm. So I'm curious about kind of all these brand new pieces that are going to be part of tomorrow night's concert. Mm-hmm. Were they conceived as a whole to like be a program, or is it just kind of a, and I don't mean this in a critical way, no. Is it kind of a hodgepodge in the best sense of the word? I mean, just a crazy quilt of all kinds of different things. Is that a better description of what's going to happen?
Yeah. It is what you would say is a hodgepodge, but what is a hodgepodge? A hodgepodge is capturing the best things in the moment that we are, which is basically what contemporary music is.
Yeah.
Right. Sometimes you want to, sometimes the best meals are the ones that you make with the stuff that's left over in the kitchen. And then you end up finding new ingredients and you end up saying, well, this was here the whole time, right? And then now that becomes your staple. And so we are creating a whole new staple with the moment that we are in right now with what we're doing. And it's also very exciting to see both of these ensembles collaborating, working together, learning to give each other you know, critique and direction and the skill sets are just amazing. Watching people, you know, sing and play. And also there's some people in my ensemble who are also in range as well.
Ah.
So there's people in mix who are also in range and things are really connecting beautifully. It's a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
I'm very happy and excited that this is my this gets to be my first concert as a professor returning here. My senior recital at Parkside was the first recital that was all original music, and then I'm coming back doing my first concert being all original music.
Wow.
I think it's great. I'm all about songwriters.
That's great. No, that's fantastic. That's great. And I assume that that Parkside Mix, as it goes on from here, a little bit like Parkside Range, every semester will be a new adventure with a new array of students. What an exciting undertaking. It sounds great. So the concert, again, is tomorrow night, Tuesday night, November 22nd. No, November 21st.
21st.
Tomorrow night is November 21st, 7 p.m. in the Francis Bedford Concert Hall. What a beautiful space in which to make music. So this will be Parkside Mix and Parkside Range performing in an evening that will include all kinds of student-written world premieres. So at the helm of Parkside Range, Amy Bowderzee, at the helm for Parkside Range, Ayisu Laite. Best wishes to both of you and to your students with what promises to be a really exciting evening of music. And thanks for being part of the morning show today.
Oh, thank you so
thanks,
much.
Greg.
It's my pleasure.
Tomorrow on the morning show, James G. Robinson, who has worked for the New York Times for many, many years, and he has written an absolutely exquisite memoir called More Than We Expected. It reflects on the remarkable life of his remarkable son, who was born with a congenital heart defect and sadly lived only to the age of 5, but packed all kinds of life and